Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine. I don't know if it's my phone cutting out or the music. Tim, did you hear the cutting out on the music?
Yeah, it did. I was about to holler and ask you if I was still there.
Well, as long as we're good, I think everybody's pretty familiar with our great quotations from our intro music that John Flank was so nice to share with us. Welcome to the Kudzu Vine. On this week's show, we're going to have Wendy Davis, and we're going to talk a little national politics, and then she's going to kind of put it in perspective with the way Iowa set the table, if you will, for the whole nation, one from the other. And then later in the show, Mark Matheny's going to be on, telling us about the Georgia General Assembly and other things going on in Georgia politics. Tim, you doing well?
Doing great, Dave. How are you, sir?
Oh, doing good. Well, I guess we had more caucuses last night, and just more information, but then everything's so close on both sides. On the Democratic side, you had Hillary Clinton winning pretty commandingly in the general and the total votes, but then if you look at the delegate count, I believe Barack Obama maybe won by one delegate, so kind of a mixed bag there.
Yeah, it was, David. They have some strange rule in Nevada about where the caucus sites actually are, and more delegates are apportioned to certain sites. For instance, she won in 7 of the 9 casino sites that were supposed to be the strength of Obama. But yet, he winds up with 13 delegates. She winds up with 12. I'm not real sure how they do that out there.
She apparently she does better, and this was in the true in New Hampshire as well, in metropolitan areas. I'm not sure how that was in Iowa, but that held true in New Hampshire as well, and then even more so in Nevada. It'll be interesting to see how that holds in the South, in South Carolina and in Georgia and other states, particularly southern states, that may play a little different given that the racial dynamic is a bit different in the South.
Oh, yeah, things are about to change. For instance, she won in Nevada by winning women and the Hispanic vote, which she won heavily. But now we come to South Carolina, where the African Americans really come into play heavily, about 50%. Senator Obama, in the latest polling, has about an 11-point lead there, and I think that is driven by the African American vote.
Yes, well, I believe Wendy just called in. Wendy, welcome.
Hello. How are you, David and Tim?
Hey, Wendy.
Good. Well, Wendy, we just actually had a question probably right before you called in. We were talking about how Senator Clinton did better in the metropolitan areas in Nevada, and that was true in New Hampshire as well. Was that true in Iowa?
You know, in Iowa, I don't think she did better many places. Iowa was like this tidal wave for Senator Obama, and I really think he's the primary reason that the turnout was twice what it was expected to be. And it was almost all over the state, but it was certainly in the metropolitan areas a little heavier than it was in the more rural areas.
For him, so he actually did better than in metropolitan areas in comparison to New Hampshire and Nevada.
Yeah. But, you know, but and Senator Clinton, I mean, she certainly had a very strong ground game across the state, but he just... I mean, frankly, everyone I know of who knew what they thought things were going to look like on January 3rd was surprised. People who've been there for, you know, years and years were just absolutely blown away.
Yes. I know that people just had no expectation that or no idea that it would be twice the record turnout like
right.
it was, and certainly nobody depended on college students to come out in the numbers they did.
Right, right. And it wasn't just college students, you know, who were sparking that big turnout. It was really, you know, widespread across the different generations. I mean, I think that's one of the things that was such a surprise, at least
yes.
to everyone I've spoken to.
Yes, well, just kind of tell us a little bit about, you worked on the Richardson campaign. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with your work and knew that you were out there working for Governor Richardson, but just kind of give us in detail to a point, recap of your work there.
Okay, well, I was hired on in the late summer to be Southern State's political director and political director for Women for Richardson. And what those responsibilities entailed were I was responsible for trying to do political organizing in 11 southern states. So it was a pretty broad stroke from Virginia across to Louisiana. And the exception there was South Carolina, which was in sort of that early state bracket. And we had a regional director who took all four of the early states, who was my peer. And then, of course, Florida was what I thought one of the emphases of my efforts would be until all the DNC falderal with them violating the the rules and jumping ahead of February 5th, and then our campaign joining the other campaigns in signing a pledge to protect the status of Iowa and New Hampshire as the big boys and prohibiting us from campaigning there. So that took Florida off my plate in September. So since they felt like I didn't have enough to do with only two jobs, one of which was to organize women nationally, they added a national surrogate director to my plate, which meant I was responsible for finding speakers to represent the governor at events across the nation. And ultimately, it ended up being my chief focus when I moved to Iowa on Halloween was to bring my mission, my goal was to bring two surrogates a day, every day, the entire month of November and December into Iowa so we would have them on hand to make sure we were covering the state. And so it was very exciting. It was an opportunity to meet a lot of very interesting people who were campaigning on the governor's behalf and very passionate about his plans and policies. And the sad thing for me is it sort of became the overwhelming bulk of my work is the focus on Iowa rather than being able to really work to build a broader network of political relationships across the South. And I was able to put together groups of women supporters in Nevada, New Mexico, and Iowa, but wasn't able to be much broader than that, just given the limitations of time and resources.
Yes, and I mean, Governor Richardson, I thought, handled himself really well. It was just, once again, just the star power of Senator Clinton and Senator Obama that kind of drowned everything else out.
Well, you know, a lot of people throw stones at the national media, and I'd be happy to join them. You know, I guess they just like things to be very simple, and apparently having more than three candidates is, you know, more than they think the American public can focus on. I mean, the really sad thing is, I mean, the governor was able to raise $22 million, which $22 million used to be a very, very strongly competitive amount for a presidential campaign. But, you know, in this year where both Senators Clinton and Obama have raised more than $100 million each, you know, $22 million is, you know, chicken scratch and just doesn't get you where you need to be in terms of competing on TV or with all the other, you know, paid efforts. Although we had 16 offices and a staff of more than 100 people in Iowa, and I know most of us are not familiar with having operations that large. I mean, I know it's a presidential scale, but we're still talking about trying to cover 99 counties. So in a lot of ways, we had some of the resources, but again, it's became on such a grander scale that we just unfortunately couldn't keep up and couldn't get the governor's message and record out as effectively as we thought we would be able to.
Yes, and he probably had some of the funniest commercials, the ones that we're talking about, like he was doing a job interview with his resume, probably some of the funniest presidential commercials you'll see.
Well, and again, our media people were very clever and very effective at trying to communicate, you know, what could be a dry topic. I mean, reading somebody's resume, you know, usually comes across as sort of boring, but they found this way to just be very clever about, and frankly, the years and years of experience that, you know, puts Governor Richardson well ahead of the rest of the field in the experience category in terms of actually, you know, having a elected position or an appointed position of significance. So.
Yes. Tim, I believe you have a question.
Yes, I did, Wendy. Been hearing a whole lot of talk about Governor Richardson being on everyone's short list of vice presidential candidates. Did you hear a lot of that talk, and was it for real?
Well, it was certainly for real in the minds of voters. If I heard, you know, the things I heard most often were, Governor Richardson has so much experience, and we just really need somebody with that kind of experience to be president, but I don't think he can win. And so maybe, hopefully, somebody will pick him as vice president, because we really need his experience. Of course, I kept saying, you know, if you'd caucus for him, we wouldn't have to say he can't win. And all the people who really thought he was so qualified and experienced and capable and would make a great president had left out the but on that sentence, I think we might still be in the race. But again, perceptions, everybody wants to be on the winning team. And, you know, and part of that's really good. I mean, you have to be astute and you have to be calculating and you have to think about, you know, what we want most as Democrats is to make sure we win in November. But again, I think Governor Richardson presents a very strong case to be able to win in November. But back to the VP question, I certainly think he would be an outstanding, you know, addition to the ticket, regardless of who the nominee is. But frankly, given the politics, I don't know that it will happen. You know, everybody, it's kind of the thing, the first time he said, now, come on, y'all, let's not beat each other up. Let's beat up Republicans, not other Democrats. Everybody thought he was coming to Senator Clinton's defense because he was, you know, seeking her vice presidential slot. And I can assure you that Richardson is not advocating that he wants to be vice president. I mean, he said very clearly over and over again, being governor of New Mexico is a much more interesting job than vice president of the United States.
Yes, and there's a point I have to make later on that, but I wanted to actually get back to you know, the fact that there was a lot of star power in being the first African-American presidential nominee or the first female presidential nominee, so exciting. Governor Richardson has a very good name, I think, for the general election, Bill Richardson. But in the primary, do you think he might have actually had a better shot if his name was a more traditionally Hispanic name, like, you know, Jorge Gonzalez? I'm just using that as an example. Do you think that would have helped in the minds people say, hey, that's the first Hispanic?
We had a real problem getting the word out to the Hispanic community that Governor Richardson, you know, was a historic candidacy. And it seemed just so ironic. Could we have called him Guillermo? I mean, the man's not going to change his name for the sake of politics, but it was really frustrating that there are so many people in the Hispanic community who didn't have, because his name is Bill Richardson, you know, because his father's a New England banker, you know, it didn't make the connection, and it didn't resonate as easily. And again, you have the national media not focusing on the campaign and not making that clear.
Yes, it's actually the opposite. I think Barack Obama, I'm sure there are moments in his life he's like, gosh, if I was just Barry Denham, which Denham is his mother's maiden name, and Barry is what he called himself throughout high school,
right.
Wouldn't it just be easier down the road? Not that that's hurting him in the primary, but then in the general, you can already see that the Republicans are trying to do a number through the, you know, internet email campaigns with his name.
Right. And using his full name, too. Trying
Hussein,
to
yes, the whole
make
deal.
It,
so
make it very clear, and also being full of lies that, you know, that he is a practicing Muslim and was sworn in on the Quran and things like that. And I just think that's just so regrettable.
Yes,
but,
and apparently I think one of the biggest things Republicans say is, he's a Muslim. Is there anything worse? Wait, he could be a Clinton. You know, that's about how they think. I mean, yes, and getting back to, I guess, to then Iowa, tell us how Iowa's different. The caucus, I mean, you see on C-SPAN, CNN, they go live into sites, but you just get the sense that TV can only convey so much.
First of all, it's not very democratic with a little d. I mean, it's obvious by the fact that we have, you know, this quote-unquote record turnout. I mean, you have 200,000 people participating. That's it. You know, think of, I mean, that's just a little bigger, I mean, that's the size of, you know, a congressional district, really. I mean, if you think about how our country is divided up. First of all, it's, you have to be at a specific location at a specific time and stay for at least an hour. Okay, we have, think about the struggles we have, and we have not only, you know, 12 hours on election day, but now we have early voting and we work on using absentee voting. But for people to participate in the caucuses, they had to be at, you know, Susie's house or at the church down the street or at the gym before 7 o'clock because the doors were shut at 7 o'clock, and you have to stay for at least an hour, in some cases 2 hours. So it's a much larger time commitment and a much more specific time commitment. And again, on a Thursday night, I don't think that's, you know, the time to get the most people to participate. But that's the system. So you start out with that limitation. And then you have what hurt our campaign a great deal was a 15% viability level. And if you didn't have 15% of the participants who showed up that night in that precinct, you weren't eligible for any of the delegates.
Yes, Tim and I, neither one are fans of the 15% rule. In that situation, we actually liked the Republican rules better.
Well, I mean, it was very unfortunate for us. And the other thing people don't really talk about is the number of delegates at each precinct. And mind you, there are 1,781 precincts across their 99 counties. That sort of raw number of delegates are then, they use another calculation to project that to the number of state delegates, which is an even smaller number. So, I mean, it's just, the math is very confusing and very complicated. And, you know, I mean, y'all know me. I mean, I'm good with numbers. And I was a math minor in college, but trying to communicate to the volunteers and our precinct captains, and I feel really bad for the party in Iowa, if you think about it. They had to have, theoretically, they had to have a trained chairperson and secretary in all 1,781 of these precincts who knew how to manage these crowds, fill out the paperwork, and, you know, conduct this caucus. So, as you can imagine, we've all seen a wide range of capabilities among volunteers. So there was obviously a wide range among how caucuses were run. And a lot of the rules are very much open to interpretation. Like myself, I was an observer, and I by no means, I mean, there was a big debate about can staffers participate in the caucus, and they have same-day registration. And I wasn't about to give up my registration here in Georgia, but, I mean, I could have walked up and signed up same-day registration and been a caucus goer, but I was an observer, and in some locations, observers were cordoned off, like in the location where the caucus I participated in, I was supposed to stand behind and not, you know, go in and actively talk to people during the caucus. I very easily could have violated that. It wasn't very, you know, well managed. But, again, I was a good girl, and I stood behind the line and just waved my gal over to me to try to coach her as we went through the night. But it's a crazy situation, and all of the, I guess, things you would expect from human nature, you know, take place, from people using abject bribery and working on people's guilty conscience. Hey, Susie, you better come over to our group because I, you know, took you chicken soup when you had a cold last week, or, you know, I shoveled your driveway, or don't you need me to babysit your cousin next week? A wide variety of things to just everybody feeling like, oh, I'm in the smallest group, I need to go join the biggest group. and you just have a lot of that going on, and your team leader can be negotiating with another group trying to, you know, consolidate your vote together to go to an uncommitted group, and by the time she gets back to communicate the deal she just made, her group could have gone away in the meantime, just floated off to different areas. So it's a wacky little system. I mean, my mom equated it to musical chairs when she saw it on TV and couldn't understand why you'd walk in the door supporting one candidate and a half an hour later switch to another one.
Yes, and you mentioned deals. It's my understanding, I think I heard on the hotline, that the Richardson campaign actually had a deal in some areas with Senator Obama and about viability, and that shows pretty clearly to me that he didn't have the secret deal with Senator Clinton all along, like, I'm going to be your vice president. What can you tell us about all that?
Well, let me clarify that a little bit. I know CNN acted like it was some, you know, big top secret negotiation, and they were breaking open that story. And it wasn't that we had cut a deal with Senator Obama's camp, but every campaign comes up with a strategy for what are we coaching our precinct captains to do in the event that in that caucus we don't reach the point of viability. And Biden's people, sort of their coaching to their folks, their strategy was, you can go, if we're not viable, you can send our people or encourage our people to go to anybody but Richardson. And yep. The reason Biden did that was pretty obvious, but he had to get past us to be able to, you know, keep going. So he just wanted to make sure his people weren't helping us. Well, in the same way, we looked at it, and if you take a step back, what Governor Richardson needed to get out of Iowa, we certainly knew we weren't going to be in the top two. We, you know, had some fading fantasy that we might end up in the top three, but we figured we were going to come in fourth. But what we needed to happen among the top three was we needed to have this sort of inevitability of, you know, Clinton just steamrolling over everybody. We need to try to stop that. So that's where the Obama strategy came from, was that we, like most people, didn't know that Senator Obama was going to dominate as heavily as he did on his own. And so our strategy was that if we weren't viable and we had an opportunity to help somebody out, we just wanted to make sure that we were helping Obama sort of put the kibosh on Clinton just running away with it. And, hindsight being 2020, we might not have done the same thing. But again, sadly, I don't think our few folks who went over and helped Senator Obama were a critical difference in that race. Again, the math, although it hurt us and hurt Senator Biden, the math really depressed how overwhelming Senator Obama's turnout was on caucus night.
Yes. Well, Wendy, you sound a little under the weather, so it won't keep you much longer.
And my parting gift from Iowa was a little dose of pneumonia.
Cold weather. Although, it looks like you've brought it with you. I woke up this morning and saw 17 and actually thought my eyes were bad and I needed to move closer to the TV. But it was truly 17. But, Wendy, we thank you for being on and sharing such information. We'll probably talk to you several shows worth. And so we hope to probably have you in a non-radio setting at some time and glean more information from you.
Well, before I go, if anybody's up this way, you know, this coming Friday night is the Floyd County Membership Supper, so if anybody wants to come up and chat some more about these or other topics, we would certainly welcome you to attend that dinner.
Yes, I had invited Chair Aikman for the Floyd County Party to come on the show, but I'll give more details from that big event later in the show.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. It's good talking with y'all.
Good having you on.
Thanks.
Bye, Wendy.
Bye.
Yes. Well, we go from one guest to another. I believe Martin Matheny's called in. Martin, how you doing?
Hey, guys. How you doing? Staying warm?
We are. Inside the house. How about you, Tim?
Oh, yeah. Doing well.
Yes.
I was listening to Wendy talk about being out in Iowa. It reminded me of doing that 4 years ago. And I was glad to be back in Georgia about this weekend when I, like you said, I saw 17.
Yeah, quite a shock. Well, Martin, the reason, I guess, people might probably saw on the blogs, the reason I have on your own is because the legislature has gotten back to town, and on one side you got craziness, and on the other side you got good proposals.
Yeah.
And we had you on. We want to have you on to kind of set the record straight on what's going on and filling us in about the goings-on of the Capitol.
Yeah, well, the big news for Democrats last week, we've actually got two things that I really want to talk about. The first is our response to the State of the State, and it's not the first time we've done it. It's the first time we've done it, I believe, with a sitting legislator, and the first time that we've done it in front of a live audience. And I was really happy to see a lot of our legislators there. I think that this is a session where you're going to see a lot of fight coming out of the Democrats because, you know, this is – government is grown-up people's work. And if you want to sit around and fight with the other members of your own party, that's fine. But Democrats are going to lead the way, and we're going to do something that's good for this state. And then the other thing that I wanted to talk about, and we can get into both of these, is a bill that was introduced on Tuesday by Representative Kathy Ash, Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, and Representative Stephanie Benfield. It's going to do some absolutely amazing things if we can get it passed. It sets up a pilot, well, it's basically a pilot program for three-year-old pre-K in Georgia. And, of course, you guys know every study that's been done shows that early learning leads to successful lifelong learning. So this is a bill that we're really excited about.
Yes, just more options, because people need to realize, I'm being an educator, if I can speak on this point, it's not that you're making kids go to preschool at three-year-olds. You're giving them the option, and that means
right.
Parents that really need that can benefit from that, because parents, you know, have different educational backgrounds and different needs for child care.
Absolutely, and, you know, I want to stress, too, that this is a very responsible bill. Like you said, we're not forcing pre-K on anybody. We think it's a great idea for every student in this state, and every study that I've seen shows that early learning is great. What this bill actually does is sets up, like I said, essentially a pilot program. It lets the agency that controls this, they're going to pick, if this bill passes, what districts get the funding to start this, and we're going to try it out and see how it works. And I believe Georgia will be the first state in the South to really get into three-year-old pre-K.
Yes, I guess
and
people – oh, go ahead.
Well, I think that plus something that that Representative Ash touched on in the State of the State response, as far as fully funding QBE, I think that the proposals that you hear coming out of the Democrats, they do and they should stand in really stark contrast to – what the governor's been doing on education. And, of course, he says one thing. He talks a great game on education. But when the chips are down, and the chips have been down in this state since the first day he walked into the governor's office, he doesn't deliver. And so we're looking this year at – now, if you listen to the State of the State address that the governor gave, you might come out of it thinking, wow, this is the education governor. He's going to do a lot for things. If you get into the details of the budget, we're looking at another $141 million of cuts to education, which brings the grand total up to $1.5 billion, with a B, taken away from education since Governor Perdue's been in office. Democrats think we can do that a little bit better. You know, we think that the greatest gift we can give our kids is education, and they're the guarantee that Georgia's going to continue to be economically successful.
Yes. Well, talking about Governor Perdue and the Republicans, I noticed that when the vetoes were overridden by the House, of course, in the Senate they were not overridden, and this caused a representative from, I believe, Ringgold, Ron Forrester, to want to impeach Casey Cagle. What can you tell us about this?
Well, let me clarify one thing. This is my understanding right now is that the Senate has not done anything on those overrides. They are they're in the Senate Rules Committee right now. As far as impeaching Casey Cagle, I think that's just another example of what the Republicans' priorities are this session. Their priorities appear to be to me, and I think to most people who are interested in seeing this state grow and succeed, the Republicans seem to be more interested in scoring points on each other. They're kind of turning into a little bit of a circular firing squad up there in the Capitol, and I think that the best thing that Democrats can do is continue to do what we've done this session and lead by example.
Yes, it's kind of like, I guess, in history you learn it, you know, way back around the turn of the century being 106 years ago, there was, I guess, the Bourbon Democrats and, Tim, do you happen to know the other group of Democrats, the Bourbons
No.
and the, any idea what I'm talking about?
No.
Well, there were two groups of Democrats. And apparently it seems like this is what the Republicans are doing. They think they're in such a comfortable position that they can almost subdivide their own groups and still control everything and not have to worry about the third group, the Democrats, which is just crazy. I mean, they're not to that point. I mean, this is a different state with a media age where it's still a two-party state.
Absolutely. I'm really proud of our Democrats in the legislature. They have come out of the gate fighting on this. In the coming week, in the next couple of days, you're going to hear from our guys about a tax plan that we're going to be introducing, and that's something that Representative Ash touched on in the State of the State response as well. I mean, we're coming out with ideas. They're coming out with, mudslinging on their own guys.
Yes.
And it's sad because Georgia has got we've got a lot of things that we need to face up to, transportation. Also something that Representative Ash mentioned, actually. How can the Department of Transportation not know where $5 billion of our money is, and how can they not know how many projects they have underway? I mean, if you run a business and you don't know how many clients you have, you're not going to be in business very long. If you run a business and you're missing a substantial chunk of capital, you're not going to be in business very long.
Yes. And talking about priorities, I don't know if you saw that poll where it talked about transportation wasn't even on the list. I think that's a faulty poll. And then when it came, tax policy was actually like second on the list, which it mm-hmm. got to me thinking that poll was the Republican Party's big-time supporters are really, reading and singing the sheet music.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, I think that what Georgia, outside of the Republican Party faithful, which is a number that's dwindling every day, I don't think that there's any disagreement, rural, urban, Republican, Democrat, whoever you are in Georgia, that we need to take a look at the way we levy and collect taxes in this state. What I don't think is that the great plan is the way to go, and I don't think a lot of people do. There are so many problems with this plan. The most important one to us, or at least to me especially, being that it throws education under the bus. If you take Speaker Richardson's idea and put education funding entirely on sales tax revenue, what happens if, as a lot of people are predicting, the country is going to go into a recession? And I know it's a little scary to say the R word, but the economy is slowing down. So you've got basically your entire education funding depending on how much people consume. And that means, well, what are you going to cut when the economy slows down? Are you going to get rid of school buses? You're going to get rid of school lunch, textbooks, teachers? So it's really a very shaky plan, and it's not in Georgia's best interests.
Yes. Now I will tell you, if you wanted to get rid of school buses, you probably would actually have the backing of discipline assistant principals. But that's a whole other story about discipline issues on the bus.
David,
yes.
It suddenly hit me what you were talking about a minute ago, the Bourbon Democrats and the Populist Democrats.
One
supposedly represented the interests of the rich, the other the poor, the workers. Yeah.
Yes. Not that either one of the Republican groups support the workers and the regular folks, but you know what I'm saying. They're two groups subdividing because they think they're in that power base. Well, Martin,
and there's a great thing on Political Insider, I think, from this afternoon, where they kind of broke that down in terms of the 2008 presidential race as well. And they talk about different franchises within the Republican Party and who they appeal to.
Yeah. And talking about, I guess, in the presidential race, but
mm-hmm.
Talking about the great plan, I think it's even more simple than talking about what might happen now. Or would you rather start paying taxes on X, Y, and Z services you don't now? I think most people would say, hey, I may not love everything the way it is now, but it's better than it would be.
Right.
Because you got a lot of small business owners. If you started having to charge sales tax on all these different services, that
mm-hmm.
would just completely change your business model and how you have to function. If a lot of TV repairmen, plumbers, things like that, if they start having to charge sales tax, report it, it would be so cumbersome. They may just decide to join bigger plumbing groups, and that's going to, limit competition.
Absolutely.
Prices.
I mean, what it is, and, I think it's really ironic that the Republicans continue to say that they're for small business, because what you're doing is creating another hurdle to starting your own small business. It's the economic concept of, you know, price of entry to the marketplace, and you're creating another hurdle that's going to make it harder to encourage enterprise and innovation. When I was younger, I got my hair cut by a guy named Mr. Barnett, and it was just him. He had his own shop, and he was the only barber there, and ran it actually out of his house. And so I guess one of my questions is, now that those are going to be taxed under the GREAT plan if it passes, what happens if Mr. Barnett doesn't collect his sales tax? I mean, are you going to fine him, or are you actually going to put him in jail?
Well, you'd have to either pay it out of your profits, or you would have to collect it. I mean, you have to make one decision or the other.
Exactly.
Pay it. I mean, obviously, but then that would cut into your price. And then once again, you might say, "Hey, I'll just go work at the Great Clips."
Absolutely.
Stop.
Absolutely. I mean, it's already difficult to start a small business, and we don't want to make it any harder, because every business that is successful starts out as a small business. Apple Computer started out in the trunk of a car. You know, Microsoft was in a garage. So small businesses become economically successful businesses, and that's the kind of enterprise innovation that we need to be encouraging. Great plan makes it harder to do that, and it also creates about 200 new taxes.
Yes, I really think that somewhere the information ought to get out there, just one comprehensive list of all of the taxes that'll be on there. If I'm not mistaken, one time on the Peach Pundit, a Republican person on there talked about how it was a tax on Jesus, and I forgot if it was on offerings or, I mean, I can't believe it would be on charitable donations, but what exactly would churches have to pay be on this?
I am not sure about that. I haven't seen anything as it affects charitable donations.
I don't think it would be that, but it would be something to do with churches, and I was just like, my goodness, that's just another area.
Well, I can tell you one thing that we have seen that would be taxed under this is ATM fees might be taxed. Now, that's hidden, and of course, bear in mind that the speaker's plan changes pretty much every 5 minutes at this point. But there is sort of this nebulous category called bank fees and bank services, which very well could include ATM fees. So if you go, you know, to a ATM that's not, you know, not part of your bank's network and take out $20 and they, you know, charge you $1.50 on it, you could be paying sales taxes on that $1.50.
Well, maybe the banking lobby will come out against it.
You know, I think that there are not very many people, and the more we find out about this plan, the fewer people there are who support it, too, I'll tell you that.
Yes, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact of where Speaker Richardson comes from.
Mm-hmm.
He's from Paulding County, and Martin, I don't know how familiar you are with Paulding County. I'm sure Tim knows a little bit about it being more in our part of the state. But
mm-hmm.
Paulding County is an area where basically, well, it was very small. Now it's developed to about getting close to 100,000 folks. But it still has really no industry to collect taxes from. And it really doesn't have that much commercial shopping. It's starting to get, you know, it has a Walmart and a Target and the
right
kind of things that pop up everywhere. But it doesn't have a mall or anything else that really drives a lot of shopping income. Therefore, they do have to pay more property tax in Paulding County. But
mm-hmm.
just because something's a big issue for one county in Georgia out of 159 doesn't mean that it needs to be the plan for the entire state that does have developed industries and does have better shopping bases.
Right. And, you know, another really large concern about this plan, too, to me, comes from something that the speaker said several months ago up in Dawson County. And this was basically what he said was one of his goals was to create, and I believe his exact words were, a median standard of service for public schools. So basically he wants to set a bar for public schools, and that's great if you're underperforming. But basically his plan was to use this as a way to boost up the underperforming schools and slow down the overperforming ones. So basically, he wants to set one standard of mediocrity for Georgia's schools, and that's not good policy.
Well, and certainly one reason that schools are better a lot of times is because you have a large parent group that's involved putting a lot of extra money to pay for extra things. Sometimes that'd even be an art teacher where the school wouldn't have one, or more supplies, learning supplies for the classroom, and you don't want to stifle parent involvement. And then sometimes it has to do with better leaders and teachers in a school, and You certainly want to produce more of those and emulate, but the first category you don't want to stifle.
Absolutely, and you know, as an educator yourself, I'm sure you can talk for hours about how important it is to have engaged, involved parents. And if those parents on the local level, in their county, in their city, in their community, say, yeah, we're willing to pay a little bit more to make our schools this much better, they ought to have the right to do that. I mean, that's local control 101.
Yes. And certainly, and this is a man that has some type of business degree from Georgia State University. You think you would understand if an area's schools are better, they can recruit industry. I guess Paulding County, once again, hasn't been good at this. And honestly, I mean, I hate to pick on them, but if you look at emerging counties, ex-urban counties in Georgia, their schools are probably lesser than a lot of those similar counties around metro Atlanta. I mean, because I do know a little bit about some of the systems around, and it's just
sure.
The truth of the matter. I mean, it's not what Fayette is. It's not what Gwinnett is. Even Bartow and ones, I guess, more on the ex-urban ring, probably Hall. So that's just, you know, that may be part of it, too, that he's seeing it through that lens. Well, the General Assembly, we want to start having more and more about the General Assembly. We thank you for kind of kicking off our coverage there. But before you go, we want to hear a little bit about the JJ Dinner and what you can tell us about that so far.
Absolutely. Well, we're really excited. I'm sure you heard the big news. Senator Clinton has committed to come. And I think that, yeah, this is going to be such a fantastic event. We're really excited about it. It's a lot of work, a lot of preparation, and we're burning a lot of midnight oil over at the party putting this thing together and just creating the best event that we can. One of the things that I'm really excited about this, you know, we have the feature on our website, and it's still up, by the way, where you can send an email through our website to your favorite candidate or candidates and invite them to come down here and send them a note. That's turned out really well for us so far. We've had, I checked just a couple hours ago, and we're getting right at, if not over, 600 total emails sent to all of the campaigns. So, of course, if you're listening and you have a candidate that has not committed to attend this thing yet, please go to the website, georgiademocrat.org, click on the JJ page, and send them an email. Tell them to come on down.
Yes. Well, and just to double check, there's no other candidates that you can let us know about on the show, is there?
No, but I think we may have some good news coming up in the next day or two.
Okay, well, and I'll go ahead and let you, while you're still on the show, let you know one other piece of news. Jane Kidd, Chairwoman Kidd, is committed to be on next week's Kudzu Vine to kind of talk about her first year in office. I guess one of the requirements would be Martin had to do a good job of being the lead fullback for this week. And I think
well,
you've done that.
I hope I set up a good route for her.
Certainly. Well, Martin, thank you for coming on, and we'll expect to hear either you or other folks throughout the session keeping us updated.
Absolutely, guys. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, y'all stay warm. Take care.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it was just good to have Martin in, and once again, I do want to tell everybody, Jane Kidd, who kind of advised us when we were starting this show with some encouragement and ideas, she's actually going to make her first appearance, and that was more us saving her than her not wanting to be on the show, but she's going to go ahead and be on next week, so I want to go ahead and announce that, and then just more news coming. Also, Tim, I guess while we're doing bookkeeping, 2 weeks from now will be Super Bowl Sunday. This will be the first time we've been on Super Bowl Sunday, and we have made an executive decision that we do not want to go up against the Super Bowl. Plus, I don't think we want to watch it with the sound down. So
no.
We're going to go ahead and air live at 5 o'clock that day from 5 to 6. We'll have a reminder other places, but on Super Bowl Sunday, go 2 hours early. That way everybody could listen and then watch the Super Bowl after the fact, because we know we're good, but we're not that good to go up against the highest rated show year in and year out.
No, we're not.
Yes, well, just a lot of information. I guess we were starting to talk about national stuff, but then we never even got over to the Republican side. And the Republican side of the ledger, to me, one thing that's pretty clear, Fred Thompson needs to get out. What do you think is pretty clear about the other side of the ledger?
Well, another thing that's pretty clear is Republican Party seems to be like a rudderless ship, David. They can't figure out 1 week to the next who they even want their nominee to be. I'm sitting here looking at the delegate count no Republican has over 59 delegates. Six candidates have already gotten delegates. They keep talking about John McCain, for instance, being the front runner. He's actually third right now in the delegate count. Each one of those candidates seems to have a weakness. Does it seem that way to you, that there's not one Republican that could pull all the different pieces of that party together right now under one strong banner?
Yes. Well, actually, now my Direct Democracy actually has McCain at second now, ahead of Huckabee. Now, who knows what numbers are right? But as I look at it, I just have to laugh at something. Other is actually ahead of Rudy Giuliani.
Yeah.
Rudy Giuliani reminds me of that kid. You know, the kid that every time you'd beat him at something, he wasn't trying. Yeah, you beat me, but I wasn't trying. And so that's what his campaign reminds me of, the I'm not trying campaign. When I try, I'll beat you. Yeah, well, he might want to start trying soon.
Yeah, well, I think it's too late, David. There's some new polling came out today. He is actually behind in Connecticut. Connecticut, of all places. He has now lost the lead in California. He's lost the lead in Florida, and Florida was what all of this was about. When you're out of sight, you're out of mind.
Yes,
he made a terrible mistake. I think he's about done.
I don't think he realized America doesn't have mayors.
No.
And talking about this My Direct Democracy counter, something that's kind of interesting, Hillary Clinton actually has over 100 delegates, the only candidate to have over 100 delegates on either side, and Uncommitted is actually second. So maybe they better watch out for Uncommitted, because it's currently ahead of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. Real clear politics, David, has been doing a count of the super delegates, and they've apportioned almost all of them. Senator Clinton, according to them, has 236 delegates already.
That was with supers.
That's with the supers. Yes. To Obama's 148 and Edwards 50.
Yes, and North Georgia gang, they were poo-pooing the idea of superdelegates. I don't personally have a problem with it. I mean, I don't know what their problem with superdelegates is, but, you know, if the Georgia gang's against it, then I'm probably for it.
Definitely.
But just a lot of things going on. And talking about polls, I know Strategic Vision just did another Florida poll. I can't wait to see their next Georgia poll. Not so much because of the presidential numbers. I want to see the Senate numbers further down to see what happens there. But in Florida, they actually have in their poll, Rudy Giuliani is running third. He's actually behind Huckabee and McCain. So, of course, if he, you know, that's what you were saying on some other polling. Giuliani's fallen there, and Mitt Romney, the leader, could this guy pick worse states to win? He wins Wyoming, it doesn't matter. Michigan, kind of got pushed aside a little bit. It's his father's home state. And then he wins Nevada, but it happens to be the day that South Carolina happens, and everybody's in South Carolina campaigning harder, so it was like he won the lesser primary there.
He really got blown off the page yesterday because everybody was watching South Carolina. He's winning in more places. He's winning more delegates. Nobody is noticing the thing. But that strategy is not going to work either, David, because Florida is going to blow that out of the water. In my heart of hearts, I believe if John McCain wins Florida, that John McCain will be the Republican nominee.
Well, unless that they have some states that come up that the anti-immigration vote really coalesces around him, because as less candidates are in, particularly if Thompson gets out sooner, that's a huge benefit to Huckabee. But that's one, as long as he can keep it divided up enough ways, the anti-immigration people may not come against him, but those folks really don't like him, and they're a pretty big number in the Republican Party.
Yeah, what a lot of people are musing about is if we get past Florida and it's still fragmented, that on the February the 5th, when 22 states vote, that candidates are going to disperse themselves around the country and cherry pick these things, and we might not even have a Republican clear favorite after February the 5th. I don't know. I really think when one of these major candidates drop out, something's going to break loose then.
Yes. And before we get to your outrage of the week, I thought I would highlight that event again that Wendy alluded to. On Friday night, actually pretty early, I believe 5:30, the doors open for the reception. The dinner and program are closer to 6:30. There's going to be in Rome the annual membership supper, and this year invited to be there is the U.S. Senate candidates, and we know we've had one of the forums already in Forsyth County, but Vernon Jones decided not to attend that forum, but he has committed to the Floyd County forum, and I know Del Cardwell and Rand Knight, Josh Lanier, I know Maggie Martinez has been told about it. This may be the first time where all the U.S. Senate candidates come in one place and speak at the same time, so that should be a rather good event to attend in Rome on Friday night.
And, David, what's the location of that event?
I believe it's the Civic Center, but I don't have that little postcard in front of me, and like I said, that's why I was going to have the chair, Scott Aikman, come on the show and tell us about it, but maybe we can also get that posted somewhere on the blogs, because that may be a good enough event that, oh, if people don't have much to do that Friday night, they might actually drive out of the county to, or out of their own county into Floyd County to see that. Well, Tim.
Hey, and,
oh, go ahead.
And I was going to say, some of you listeners can get your chance to get your first look at me, too. I promise I'll be there with you guys Friday night, David.
Yes, speaking to how big of an event it is, you'll be at the annual membership supper, but not at the JJ. So that's how big an event that is. And so, Tim, go ahead and give us the outrage of the week.
Okay, the first week of this session of the Georgia legislature is in the books, as we talked about a few minutes ago. Now, does anyone out there know what was actually accomplished? I shouldn't be at all surprised if the average voter has no idea what they did. That is probably because they really didn't do very much. I'm going to tell you all the four main things that really got done. And I want you to remember when I'm telling you this that I'm not making any of this up. First, the governor delivered his State of the State message, and with it came his proposed budget for the next fiscal year. This budget calls for twice the spending that this state had when the decade began. And the so-called property tax relief that they're touting is a paltry amount. Most of it goes to large property owners. The rest of us wouldn't realize enough out of it to take our families to the movies. So much for the great fiscal conservatives. The second bit of folly involves drought legislation. Out of committee has come legislation that would earmark $36.5 million to set up a data gathering operation to figure out what to actually do and what resources are available to do it with. This would take 3 years, according to the sponsors. So they're going to take 3 years to talk about what to do. They should know. Roy Barnes had a plan in 2002, and now they're gathering data. Oh, gee. Now, number three on the list involves guns. Our old friends at the National Rifle Association got the bright idea that people should be able to carry their firearms to their places of employment. Of course, the State Chamber of Commerce opposed it, as did most business owners and law enforcement, etc. This put the GOP legislature between a rock and a hard place because they were having to choose between two of their core constituencies. So what did they do? They passed a bill that would allow more firearms into state parks. Oh, whoopee. Now admit it. Don't you folks feel safe going to Stone Mountain now, knowing that every other person you encounter is packing heat? And then there is item number 4, which is my personal favorite of this group. Last Monday, the House voted to override 12 vetoes by Governor Perdue from last year's session. These 12 overrides then went to the Senate, where they were promptly sent to the Rules Committee, which means that most of them will never again see the light of day. Lieutenant Governor Cagle then added fuel to the fire by stating that the Senate was, quote, in no hurry to address these overrides. Well, as you could imagine, that didn't exactly sit that well with the House. So on Thursday, as was mentioned earlier, State Representative Ron Forster from right up here in Ringo began to float the idea of impeaching Casey Cagle, and some in the House were actually liking that idea. So there you have it, your state government in action. And if the first week was like this, just imagine what the rest will be like. It just continually amazes me that the Republicans are in firm control of state government, and they fight each other more than they ever fought the Democrats. And the losers of the fight are the people of Georgia who wait for results and get none, David.
Yes, I have no real faith that Casey Cagle will be impeached. It's all kind of funny, but I have to say there's probably a lot of Democratic consultants out there that just love the idea that this happened. Because now, as soon as he runs for governor in 4 years, or I guess at this point 2 years, you know, the ads can happen. Casey Cagle, so bad, or whatever the word they may use, so ineffective that members of his own party tried to impeach him.
Yeah,
I mean, you can see it.
Oh, yeah, it's coming. It's coming. But have you ever seen anything like this in your life? The Republicans firmly control state government, and they just can't run it. They can't even get along with each other. It's a comedy of errors.
Yes, I saw a movie recently on video. I really forget the name of it, but it was some kind of fantasy-type film, not really science fiction. It was set kind of in the old world, and there were about 5 brothers that were trying to be king. And the dying king, their father, had them chase some ring to be a king, and they killed each other trying to get the crown. And that's what they remind me of. They're all the same party. They're all the same family, but they have to kill each other off for the power.
Yeah, but in the meantime, they're supposed to be governing, David. They're supposed to be getting things done for the people of this state. I mean, we're the Empire State of the South, and we're quickly losing that title.
Yes, I guess they figure if they keep us stuck in so much traffic, then we can't go home and use the water that we don't have. That's the plan.
I like it.
I mean, but those are the two big issues in Georgia, or two of the big issues in Georgia, and they're worried about being able to carry guns and, you know, not pay certain taxes. And the thing is, think about this. Think about when you get caught in a traffic jam and all that road rage going on when you're headed to the state park. Now you can have your gun with you. And they can have more of those kind of incidents.
Oh, yeah.
It's just people with no priorities are the wrong priorities. But, Tim, another good show, and we'll be back next week for a big show with Jane Kidd as our special guest, talking about her first year in office, her plans for the next year, and probably a pretty good JJ preview. And I have a feeling, like Martin said, there may be more names to happen running for or coming to speak at the JJ dinner. But, Tim,
sounds
until
good.
Then. See you then.
All right. Bye. Good night.